I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. The DuPont Company, based in Wilmington, Delaware, has been in business for more than 200 years. Dow Chemical, based in Midland, Michigan, was founded in 1897. They announced on Friday that they were merging into one mega company, Dow DuPont. Today, they both employ 100,000 people, and their combined worth is something like $130 billion. That is about to change with the expected layoff of thousands of workers and the closure of offices and plants to cut costs and reward shareholders. The plan is to split into three companies in 2017. This is big news in the business world and in this region as well. We asked Joe DeStefano to join us. He's business reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He has written the Philly Deals column and blog for the Inquirer since 2008. And Joe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. A big deal. A really big deal?
This is a really big deal, sure. Well, these are two companies that, as you say, go back many generations, and they were family-owned companies, and they've morphed way beyond that. They have global operations. There are company towns all over the world where Dow products and DuPont products are made, sometimes in competition. They're in a lot of the same sectors. And there is two parts to this deal. It's what you said. It's a very large merger. But following it within 2 years, they are claiming they're going to actually split this three ways into a great big materials company, which is mostly Dow, with one of the most profitable parts of DuPont, into a great big pesticide and seeds company, which is part DuPont and part Dow, and there's some concerns about that already expressed, and into a so-called specialty materials company, which is sort of everything that doesn't fit. Mostly DuPont.
And how long has this merger been in the works?
Well, Andy Leveris, who's the chief executive of Dow, says that he's been trying to do this for 10 years.
10 years.
Certainly 8 years ago, they made a run at it. Ed Breen, who is the head of the DuPont company, and a fellow who, when he came in, already brought with him the reputation of a guy who's really good at spinoffs, who can, if your definition is making a lot of money for the shareholders by breaking up a company into its component parts. It's not such a weird conglomerate, but a group of related businesses that that makes sense. And your guest from Wharton knows a great deal about those and has measured those. So that's the second part. And he says that from the day he joined the DuPont board way back in February, this was under discussion.
Wow.
Now, at the time, the DuPont company's official line is, no, we want to keep our company independent. You know, we want to work out our destiny. We want to preserve our research and development. Sure, we can keep cutting costs to keep the investors happy. And there was a big fight about that.
Well, I mean, we are talking about layoffs, assuming this gets approved and moves ahead. Layoffs here in the Delaware Valley?
DuPont alone says that they're going to cut more than 5,000 people before the deal gets finished.
Wow. Which is, imminently then?
That is, they want to get this deal done. They want to get it done next year. And within the next 18 months, 2 years, I think, is their target date for splitting into pieces. And that's a $700 million cut. Now, the total cuts they're talking about, in addition to that, are $3 billion. So if you extrapolate that, you know, you're talking about many, many thousands of people. You know, plants closing, a lot of headquarters jobs to be lost. 10% of research is going to go. There's a big concern in America about corporate support for research and development. You know, is the DuPont Experimental Station in Wilmington, are the various Dow locations going to go the way of, you know, 18 Bell Labs and Xerox Labs and others that were very large RCA, you know, that really innovated a lot of American industry. And it's getting harder to do. Out at Penn, you know, they spend $1 billion a year on research, but most of it comes from the government, and it's the same as they spent 10 years ago. It's really hard to get dollars loose from the private sector. Some of the private sector companies that have supported research are Dow and DuPont. They're coming together. Is there going to be less of this going forward?
So what kind of impact here in the Delaware Valley, and specifically in the Wilmington area?
Well, in Wilmington, people are really scared. I mean, DuPont has already pulled its headquarters out of the city of Wilmington, leaving these massive structures that are still inhabited by one of their cast-off or spin-off companies, Chemours. We don't know how long that's going to last. They're really feeling the pressure down there. There was, you know, if you go back 40 years, I mean, there are company towns all over America. You go to Rochester and the university and the libraries and many of the institutions, you know, are from Kodak. You know, Midland, I'm sure, is the same with Dow. Detroit, famously, with the automakers. And as these companies grow, the towns become, you know, wonderful places. They wanted to bring executives and investors from all over the world to live in these places. So you want to have some nice hotels. You want to have great restaurants. You want to have legitimate theater. You know, DuPont owned four golf courses at one point right in Wilmington. They still have three of them. And all of that is now looked at as fad, as negative. The investors don't like to see it. And that's among the stuff they're targeting. It's not major expense, but there are many layers of bureaucracy, supposedly, that they are going after, strategists and accountants. And, you know, it's a little bit analogous to what you see over at the Philadelphia School District. You know, they've lost a third of their students to charter schools, and it's been terrible pressure for them because what do we do with this administration we've built up? What part do we cut? We don't know how many we're going to lose next year. And they've had a very hard time planning for this because nobody really taught them how to. They didn't think that was part of their job. Well, the corporations go through a lot of this, and the headquarters don't know. How do we adequately support the businesses we have left? How do we adequately support the new ones? DuPont's been buying and selling companies since the 20s. I mean, they were broken up. They had a gunpowder monopoly. They were broken up by the federal government. They made an awful lot of money in World War I. They were given patents that the Allies took from the Germans. And they just went to town with that. You know, they paid a lot of money for scientists and researchers. They developed nylon and Kevlar and many, many products. But they bought a lot of them, too. They bought a lot of subsidiaries. And some of the timing of their, you know, they own the General Motors company. In the 50s, DuPont was the most valuable company in the world for a time, largely on the strength of the fact that one of their biggest customers, General Motors, was also controlled by the company and by the family. The government came back and really broke up the family's hold. They broke up the family securities company, Christiana Securities. They made DuPont more or less divest from General Motors. And some have argued that General Motors really peaked toward the end of the DuPont ownership in the 60s and then went downhill for the next 40 years after there was a single guiding intelligence out of Wilmington.
I mean, this feels like the end of an era then.
Well, it is in the chemical industry, but we've seen this in Philadelphia, say, in the banking industry. You used to have six big multi-billion-dollar banks that really set policy in this country, and that all disappeared in the 80s and the 90s when it became possible to buy them. And they merged, they consolidated. There's a few very large banks, you know, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citi, that really substitute for dozens and dozens that we had formerly. And that process is still going on. As an industry matures, you come to that point. We had hundreds of auto manufacturers. Very early, they coalesced to half a dozen and really to three. And so some of this is what's going on with chemicals now.
Well, and you're talking about layoffs, so the possibility of 5,000 layoffs. I'm assuming these are well-paying jobs, people with PhDs or kind of commensurate skills.
5,000 is just the first step. There's going to be a lot more than 5,000 layoffs if they go through with this on the lines they're suggesting. Now, they've been very careful. Ed Breen at DuPont has been very careful to say, you know, there's really two areas of the company he doesn't want to mess with. And one of them is research and development because he is very defensive of the innovation pipeline, as he calls it, all these great new ideas coming along. And the other is what he calls customer facing, the salespeople who are out there all over the world, people who are really good at going to Tokyo and selling to the car manufacturers, who are really in the electronics manufacturers, and people who have been scouting new markets around the world. Well, what does that leave? That leaves manufacturing, process, continuing to consolidate and shut facilities, continuing to locate new ones that don't have a lot of people working there in places in the world where maybe they're not as expensive to operate. Now, they pay the senior people, the PhDs and the managers. They have one scale around the world. I went to DuPont's plants
around
down in Mexico years ago. In Tlalnepantla, for example, they're paying those engineers the same as they were paying the ones in Edgemoor, Delaware. But when you go down to the raw materials and the things that they're buying, no, there's different. And a lot of the savings they're frankly planning to take out of the supply chain, out of the raw materials, out of the vendors, out of the contractors, and really squeeze. They're claiming they can do a lot of that.
So why merge these two companies and then break them up into three more companies, what, a year and a half later?
You know, a lot of people I'm hearing from at DuPont are very skeptical of this. They say, you know, it looks great on paper, but they've seen so many mergers and so many divestments, and they don't all go well. The most recent divestment that DuPont did
two divestments ago was Exalta. That was their paints company. That's based in Philadelphia. That has an outside private equity owner. I believe it was Carlyle Group. They have a direction for that business. It fits with their other companies. It seems to be doing well. The more recent spinoff was Chemours. It's a lot of their older and worn and environmentally difficult plants, and they were accused by some of the labor unions that represent the people in those plants of trying to get out of really ugly situations with bottomless financial obligations. And in fact, Chemours has been losing money, had to cut its dividend. Ed Breen was asked this point blank when he announced the merger, well, are you going to back up these companies, and are you going to back up Chemours, where we're losing money on our investment that you gave us? And he said, no, you know, that's a separate company, and we're not responsible anymore for what goes on there. So there is a sense. But if you put yourself in the company's position, you can ask that question. You can say, well, if they want to have anything left, what do they do about all these old, some of them 50 and 70 years old, environmental obligations? What do they do about their pension obligations to pay these tens of thousands of retired people? And some of those plans are not well funded. What do we do about the tax obligations? These are both American companies. Andy Lavaris, the CEO of Dow, spent a lot of time with President Obama early in his term talking about, and Ellen Coleman of DuPont was in on those talks too, I believe, how do we bring manufacturing back to the U.S.? Can you get this burden of health care off the employer and put it on someone else, you know, so that we don't have to constantly be paying more for that every year? I mean, they've thought real hard about these questions. They've asked, you know, and it's just not clear where they go.
Oh, interesting. We're going to get more into the details of this, but this seems like the goal is to reward shareholders, yes?
Well, who owns the companies? Now,
well, exactly.
Your law here in Pennsylvania is a little bit different. It's a little bit unusual. In Pennsylvania, a company has broad powers to do what's best for the stakeholder, which could be, in theory, the employees, the communities in which they're located. You know, in practice, is very often the CEO. He goes for the deal that's better for him personally. When Core States was sold, they didn't take the highest offer. They took the one that was the best for the CEO. Huh. In Delaware, in New York, in most states, it's all about the shareholders. It's really about doing what is best for the investors. When you sell stock on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ market and any other market, you're getting up on a tiger and you're riding that tiger. You got to show that you're making money. You're going to make more money, just like the best companies in the market. If Facebook, if Google, if Apple are trading at many, many times their actual profit, the expectation is they're going to make, you know, not just $1 billion a week like Apple is. Maybe you're going to go toward $1 billion a day. And what business, the argument goes, do you as a company have being in that same market with Apple and Facebook and Google if you can't show us some of the same? You can't have all these rebuilding years is the pressure they get from their investors. You got to show us results, and you got to show them to us, not immediately, but soon. You got to give us a timetable. You got to stick to it, and God help you if you tell us you're going to make this many billions of dollars next year and you don't keep up to it.
And we're almost up in a break here. It's interesting to compare DuPont that goes back to, what, 1802 with Apple, obviously, you know, this new and very profitable company. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We're talking about the proposed merger between Delaware-based DuPont and the Dow Chemical Company. Joe DiStefano has been covering this as business reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dennis Berman, financial editor of the Wall Street Journal, will be joining us after this very short break, and then we'll be talking with Emily Feldman from the Wharton School. And we want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499, especially if you work for DuPont, you live in the Wilmington, Delaware area. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Joe DiStefano, again, business reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, reporting, as many people have, about this merger announced on Friday between DuPont, which is headquartered in the Delaware area, and Dow Chemical, based in Midland, Michigan, the idea of merging the two companies and then breaking them apart in 2017. And again, you can join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments that you might have for our guests? And joining us now is Dennis Berman, financial editor of the Wall Street Journal. And Dennis Berman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
You call this a loser's decision, that this is companies that have given up faith in themselves. How so?
Well, I don't think I use the exact term a loser's decision. I think I said it's an America playing not to lose as compared to an America playing to win. I think Joe, just hearing him for a few moments, was pretty eloquent in describing the necessities of the market that are pushing companies to cut costs, to rationalize, to pare their workforce and their R&D. And why is that? There are a number of reasons. It can, you know, so many of them. But to a large extent, it's the basic fact that there's not a lot of growth in the American economy right now. It's growing somewhere between 2 and 3%. The global economy is growing a little bit faster than that. But when I say it's an America playing not to lose, it's basically CEOs who are making the safe decision. They're making the decision to improve their profits by cutting costs. They're not looking to expand into categories that might be a little bit far afield. The market would punish them. They're not looking to put a lot of money into R&D. Again, the market would punish them. We are in sort of a very malaise-like period. It's not terrible, but it's not great. And for that reason, it's an America basically playing not to lose.
What you also say is the economy is not robust enough yet to keep shareholders happy. Is that people who have stock want maximal returns?
They do. And I think it seems pretty heartless sometimes, particularly for people in Delaware. Delaware has been particularly hit over the years. When you think about the companies that have been lost from Delaware and will continue to be lost from Delaware, I think the state has got some troubles ahead for it. But you also have to think about the alternate scenario. Let me raise that. That's the alternate scenario of France, where the economies, frankly, are not as flexible as they are in the United States, or even a very state-controlled economy like China, which you would view from afar that it's doing very well. But there are so many inefficiencies in the in the Chinese economy that it makes for some bad outcomes there. So there's no one great answer. I think that people on Wall Street and economists would tell you having a flexible economy that can do a deal like Dow and DuPont is actually in the long term a good thing, rather than having to uphold or keep the flame for some sentimental reasons. But nonetheless, it does not feel like a great day for celebrating American capitalism when Dow and DuPont announced their merger.
You want to weigh in on that, Joe? You just gave me a scrunchy face. Go ahead.
I love the way he summarizes things. You know, the Journal's been all over this story. They've really done a marvelous job showing this coming and going. Point we raised.
Is it a sad day?
Yeah. Well, it's a sad day for people in Delaware. He's absolutely right about that. And I've been getting calls from all over the area from people who are just outraged. And they feel a little betrayed because there was a real interesting incident this spring. You actually had a contested board election, a very rare thing in these big companies in America. Nelson Peltz, who his company's now at this point of almost 3% of DuPont, raised his own, not even a full slate, but four directors to run against DuPont nominees. And there was a big multi-million-dollar campaign. One of the great things when you're a public company is you have to disclose how much you spend on things like this. And they spent millions of dollars on advertising and phone calls. It was very much like a political campaign. It all came down to this dramatic, first annual meeting at the new headquarters outside Wilmington, down past the research station. And the sitting CEO, Ellen Kullman, won. And a lot of people thought, oh, that's great. It's a victory for the old America, for DuPont Company charting its own destiny, for long-term research and development. Well, 5 months later, she was out. And she had promised, we're going to hit these targets, and they had consistently missed their targets. But how was Nelson Peltz, with 3% of the company, 2% even, able to leverage this? How is Dan Loeb over at Dow, with 2% of the company, able to have such an outsized voice? Well, we saw in the voting, which Coleman's faction, the dominant, the incumbents narrowly won, that there were actually quite a few investors who went with Peltz, with the insurgents. And they were, there were people like Mike Crofton over here at Philadelphia Trust Company, who was just very, very adamant that these people who were running DuPont were running it into the ground. They were not going to be able to sustain the dividend at the rate they were going. He wanted change, and he knew that Nelson Peltz was a guy who could deliver value.
Wow.
Because this is the guy who forced Kraft and Heinz and many other American companies to shape up and close a lot of plants and throw a lot of $20 an hour guys out of work. And he was quite confident that something of that order on a larger scale was what needed to be done at DuPont. And a lot of people agreed with him. The two groups that voted in favor of keeping things the way they were, the status quo almost, which was not a very dynamic status quo because Ellen Coleman was also committed to cutting costs and reducing overhead, were the small investors who were in the community. You know, DuPont has had a very progressive policy about making shareholders out of workers. And many of those people, retirees, came into the meeting, you know, clutching their proxy statements and saying, we really want to keep the company here. And then, interestingly, the very largest investors, you know, Vanguard and BlackRock. Vanguard owns 5% of every company in America and 10% of some. And these big index fund companies, you know, they talk about being on the investor side, but they're also very conservative. And they would not vote to oust the incumbent directors. And that is why they were able to hang in a little bit longer. But the pressure didn't go away.
Dennis, I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes. Do you anticipate more mergers on the horizon?
Yes, this has been one of the most active, in fact, the most active year for mergers in the history of the U.S. economy. Over $4 trillion worth of deals. And you can see sort of the same principles playing out as they are in Dow and DuPont and other mergers. Say, take Anheuser, which wants to buy SAB Miller, right? Sort of the impossible scenario of Budweiser and Miller being together under the same roof. That's happening. You can see it happening in the health insurance space, where essentially four of the largest health insurers want to combine into two. Again, pressure on the economy, and frankly, pressure from outside the U.S. economy on U.S. businesses forcing companies to try to rationalize the best they can. Now, I think the thing that comes clear to me when I get on a United Continental flight and I sit in the middle seat and my knees are literally buckled up against the seat in front of me, I can think about sort of it's made physical, it's made whole, it's made real what's happening across the landscape as these mergers come together. And that is, it's about rationalizing again. It's about cutting costs again. It's about United and Continental, for example, doing the best they can for their shareholders. So there are some benefits to it. We're all in some way, if you have a retirement plan, we're all beneficiaries of an efficient economy. But there are also some downsides, too, whether you're on that middle in that middle seat or drinking the Bud Miller, if that's going to be a beer, perhaps it will be. It probably won't taste too good either. But it's made whole what's happening across the U.S. landscape.
And obviously no one wants to sit in that middle seat. Well, Dennis.
No, but we all figuratively we all are, and I hate to say this, but I fear somewhat for the people in Delaware and DuPont, having been given decades and centuries of promise and expectations. I think it's going to be a tougher road ahead.
Well, we appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dennis Berman, financial editor of The Wall Street Journal. Joe DiStefano staying with us for the rest of the hour, a business reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And joining us now is Emily Feldman. She's assistant professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Her work focuses on divestitures, and spinoffs, and has been listening as we have been talking about this proposed merger between DuPont and Dow Chemical. And Emily Feldman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. And to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. That's the number to call to join our conversation. Particularly interested in hearing from folks in the Delaware part of our listening area. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you make of this proposed merger, Emily?
So I think it's great, not because of the merger itself, but because of what's going to happen next. So I feel like a ray of sunshine on this gloomy day after the conversation that we've been having for the past
half hour. It does feel a little gloomy,
doesn't
it?
Yeah, definitely. So I think what's fascinating about this deal is that, yes, we're combining these two companies, Dow DuPont, and there's this legacy issue, and they've been around for hundreds of years, and you know, we sort of have this cost-cutting, rationalizing sentiment that we've been talking about. On the other hand, if you look at what's going to happen next, the company is planning to break itself apart into three different pieces, as Joe was talking about at the beginning of the conversation, the agriculture business, the chemicals business, and then kind of the grab bag of the rest of the stuff. And what's great about deals like spinoffs and divestitures is that they actually allow companies, the remaining companies that emerge from them once those deals are complete, to funnel resources more efficiently, to direct their capital more efficiently. And the evidence all points to spinoffs and divestitures enjoying really positive stock market response, so shareholders benefit relative to pre-divestiture performance, and B, operating improvements as well within these companies. So we start to see more profitability, more efficiencies. So in general, we actually start to see gains to the entities that remain once these breakups are complete.
Joe, let me go back to you because, in certain ways, the story is framed as employees versus shareholders.
Well,
should we see it that way?
Their interests are not always in the short run in common. Now, there's an argument that if you don't have happy owners, you don't have a business. And, who is going to invest and who is going to put that new factory together and who is going to hire programmers? And that at the end of the day, there's got to be some profit here. There's got to be some story. There's got to be some attraction or you're not anywhere. But it's certainly true that if you're in your 50s and you've, spent all your time on a set of problems and, you see that that's narrowing, you've got a tough decision to make. How are you going to stay relevant in life? And a lot of engineers and scientists traditionally did that by getting onto the business side.
Right.
They would travel, some years, be away from their families or take the families with them. They would rise in management, and the reward at the end was you get to run something, you make a lot of money, and you retire very, very nicely. And a lot of the pressure has been to cut out that whole part of the career ladder, as well as the people on the bottom that are making stuff. Chambers works over in Salem County, New Jersey. DuPont had tens of thousands of people working there in World War II. It was per capita the wealthiest county in New Jersey. When they scaled all that back, it became very nearly the poorest county in New Jersey. There's still a few thousand people working there, but nothing like what it used to be. So at the bottom, you get those cuts, and in the middle, you get those cuts. And, you were trying to convince young people to go into science. We're trying to find money for more PhDs. What is the career ladder really? Hmm. These young programmers. I was at my story in last Sunday's Inquirer. There are members of the DuPont family are involved in efforts to try and train more programmers in Delaware. And the lifestyle they lay out is that this is 80 or 100 hours a week. You've got to keep yourself current. You can do a great job for a company for a couple of years, but you're not going to be able to make a career of it. You don't want to be like these guys leaving Unisys that were great stuff 30 years ago, and now they can't get hired. They're bringing in people from India. They're training kids. So this is pressure on people at all levels of our economy.
It feels like, in some ways, a race to the bottom.
If you can produce enough wealth at, some point, and you go into shops here in Philadelphia, you go into shops around, and there are young people, recent engineering graduates, people who have no particular background in computers but have taught their way through, and they're doing well. And, they're living in nice apartments, and they're eating at restaurants, and they're starting to reproduce a little bit. You get the medical school students, there are groups that still have, are developing a future here. But there's so much competition for the good ideas. And that is really the big issue in society is what is the hope for young people? Where are good things to put your effort into when you have all that energy as a young person so that you'll be rewarded? And the old corporate route, for years people have known it's not what it used to be.
Well, let me go back to you, Emily, and help us understand how these activist investors work. And I think for some people, myself included, you say the word activist and you think of people fighting against fracking or mountaintop removal or some of these other activist ideas. This is a very different use of the word, even activist investor.
Well, so it's the corporate version of what you just described, basically. So basically these hedge funds, these private equity firms amass kind of a stake in the companies that they wish to see change imposed in. So they'll view a company like Dow or DuPont and say it's being mismanaged or it's not being as managed as effectively as it could be. And by amassing this ownership stake in one of those companies, they have a voice, right? Because they're large owners compared to your average person out on the street who might own some shares in the company,
like 20 shares,
nearly the amount that that these activists might hold in these corporations. And so, by doing so, they can sort of advocate for change, right? And an extreme example is what we saw at DuPont kind of last spring and over the summer with the proxy battle and sort of big changes being pushed. This can happen on a smaller scale as well. I think that this is sort of what we've witnessed here. This deal really is kind of a culmination of this sort of activist pressure on both of these companies, actually, on both Dow and DuPont.
And Joe, we're talking about this man Peltz. I mean, he had, what, 3 or 4% or has 3 or 4% of DuPont. I mean, that's not majority, but 3 or 4% is enough to give someone leverage?
The man has a track record. You know, he's gone into a lot of big old manufacturing companies and gotten them to change their way of doing business. And that has had the immediate effect of raising the share price. And if you're an investor, frankly, you know, unless you have a personal, visceral connection to the company, unless your kid works there, unless your pension is tied to it, you want the share price to go up. And if it doesn't go up, you're going to get out and buy something else. So a guy like Peltz comes on the scene, you know, you think of what happened at Kraft, you think of what happened at some of the other places he went after. You think that's going to happen for my company too, the company I own shares in too. I want Peltz in there. That is the reaction you get from the small investor, from the middle-sized firm, from the pension fund manager.
So they say, we're with Peltz.
We're with
Peltz on this.
Overwhelmingly what I found. The people I quoted, the people who called me who were not willing to be quoted, the people I talked to, unless there was that personal connection to the company, or unless you were the very, very large firms that don't like to make waves because, you know, Vanguard and BlackRock, they're out there selling product to retirement plans. They're out there selling product to these big corporations. They want to be neutral, maybe. Maybe they don't want to put as much pressure as a Nelson Peltz does. And so they've been, up till now, the great stabilizing influence here that kind of slows down the hedge funds from and the activists from going that much harder.
Well, and we're almost having a break here. I mean, do what do we call them, investors, activist investors, do they make these companies better?
Well, better. So down the road, I mean, if you look at what happened at Tyco, which is the company that Ed Breen, who runs DuPont, previously ran, you know, he came in there. They had a terrible scandal. Their CEO, Ed Kozlowski, went to jail for years. And he came in there with a mandate to turn it around. And he tried to turn it around. He said, you know, he wants to convince people that all these disparate businesses, you know, fire alarms and electrical connections, you know, ought to belong under one roof because we're so darn smart. We can show these businesses what to do. Shareholders didn't buy it. They kept the price fairly low. So then he started breaking it in pieces, eventually broke it in 6 pieces, and some of those companies are more successful today.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the proposed merger between Delaware-based DuPont and Dow Chemical to create a corporate entity worth billions of dollars, clearly. And then the plan is to break this new company into 3 separate companies. Talking with Joe DiStefano, business reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also with us, Emily Feldman, assistant professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Emily Feldman from the Wharton School and Joe DiStefano from the Philadelphia Inquirer about the proposed merger between DuPont and Dow Chemical, coming up with a mega company called Dow DuPont, and then the plan is to break it into 3 smaller companies in 2017. And again, 1-888-477-9499, and send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I mean, during the break, we were talking about this proposed merger, and I guess one of the questions is, does this pass antitrust muster? Joe, can I go back to you on that? Or Emily, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah.
Joe, go ahead.
Just real quick, Senator Charles Grassley out of Iowa barely let the ink dry on the announcement of this deal. And he said, you know, I'm for Iowa farmers, says Senator Grassley, and I'm really concerned that you're going to drive up this cost of seeds, you're going to drive up the cost of pesticides, genetically, you know, modified organisms. And I'm against that, and I think the government needs to look at this real hard. And, you know, we thought in Philly that Comcast Time Warner was going to be a shoe-in. You know, the president's a good friend of Brian Roberts, visited him up at his vacation house. That didn't go through. So I think there's a lot we don't know.
Go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, so what's unique about this deal in terms of the antitrust implications is that it's not just the two companies combining that matters. Like, the Dow-DuPont combination in and of itself isn't relevant from an antitrust perspective. It's actually much more contingent on the spinoffs that we're going to see, on the split that we're going to see in a couple of years, right? So its competition has to be not hurt, I guess, within each of these individual subdivisions that we're going to be looking at. So the chemicals business, the agriculture business. And that's what Joe is talking about here, that, you know, when Grassley is complaining about the Iowa farmers, it's the agricultural business and the antitrust implications of combining Dow and DuPont within that particular business rather than the two companies as a whole that's really relevant. So I think that's an important feature to point out about this deal that's unique, maybe relative to some other major mega mergers that we've looked at.
And it seems the activist investors felt as if at least DuPont, probably Dow Chemical, had a big fat bureaucracy that needed to be, what, taken apart?
Oh, absolutely. Down? Yeah. I mean, you know, this is sort of a classic, you know, big corporation problem, right? When you have these monster corporations, there is a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot of layers of management. There's a lot of employees. Maybe there's a lot of redundancies that happen. And so, you know, costs can be cut by slimming companies down. And that's really one of the major advantages that we see out of spinoffs, that we can eliminate a lot of this bureaucracy because we have these more focused operations that are, you know, doing one thing and doing it well, and we don't need 10 layers of management on top, and we don't need to coordinate with 6 other divisions within the firm. It's much more streamlined. So I think that that's a really big advantage of this kind of merge to split structure that we see with this Dow DuPont deal.
I mean, Joe, it seems like when you look at activist investors, you can see several sides of perhaps the role they play. One is maybe cleaning up a kind of bureaucracy that needs some cleanup. But again, you know, going back, one worries about people losing their jobs and, of course, the effect regionally.
Well, you know, I've heard a lot about bureaucracy at DuPont going back 25 years when I worked for the paper down there. I mean, there was always, oh, we're going to cut bureaucracy. Oh, we've got too much. You got to have to wonder just how much of that is left. People will always complain about how slow their company is to do the things that they want done right now. But a lot of times, you know, those things grow up for a reason. The DuPont company made a lot of poisons over the year. You know, people killed as recently as last year and the year before in their plants. And, you know, it's dead serious, the stuff they do. And there's reasons why they have, you know, a lot of people counting, a lot of people measuring, a lot of people, you know, strategizing. And when you take too much of that away, you know, you just have the factory. Somebody's got to direct the factory. Somebody's got to think further years down the road. Somebody's got to ask the hard questions. Are you taking too much of that? A lot of these businesses are cyclical. A lot of these businesses expand and shrink. Agriculture, absolutely cyclical. And, you know, when you have multiple different companies under one roof, different businesses, they can kind of support each other. They can centralize research. They can centralize some aspects of administration. When you take all that away, these guys are going to sink or swim, and somebody else is going to come along and pick them up. If you're in the business of making deals, this is a great deal because there'll be lots of opportunities. If you're working for one of these places, you know, if you've set up your career around this, you have a lot to be worried about.
Let me get Jim from, looks like, Paulsboro to join our conversation. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm a recent, well, not recent, 2009, I retired from DuPont. And my concern is, what is going to happen to the retirees' pensions and health care? It's a little scary.
Have you heard anything, Jim?
I haven't heard anything. Nothing.
So,
well, Joe, and you mentioned this earlier. That's one of the, yeah, I guess, unanswered questions.
So we're a union shop at the Inquirer, and we went through a bankruptcy, and they froze our pensions, and now they're telling us they don't know if they have enough money to pay them indefinitely. So I hear you. Now, the company, there's things that they're required to do by law, and there's things that they agree to do voluntarily, and then there's things that they are contractually bound to do because they promised the union. And I don't know completely what your situation is, but that's going to determine what happens. Companies want to reduce their retirement obligations. A lot of times, the first thing to go in a situation where there's a lot of pressure is the post-retirement health care. If you've got people who are not yet Medicare age, you know, there have been situations where the people will lose that coverage. Now, usually, it very often doesn't come to that until you're very near a point of bankruptcy. So if I worked for Chemours, which is a company that was spun off by DuPont and a lot of the pieces aren't making money and the company as a whole isn't making money, I'd be looking down the road a few years and a little worried about where that's going to head. Are they going to get in a bankruptcy situation? There are some pension guarantees. Congress hasn't always seen fit to fully fund that. We haven't yet gotten the situation where pensions are completely wiped out because there was no funding. But unless Congress moves, and there are a lot of people in Congress who don't want to see pensions, you know, guaranteed by the government anymore, you know, that's something to talk to your congressman about.
Yeah, indeed. And Jim, good luck to you, and thanks for the call.
I mean, the short answer is you'll probably be okay, but if things really do deteriorate, you know, pay attention to all the stuff that they send you. If you're in a union, you know, keep in touch with the union and talk to your congressman about pension.
And it sounds like be on the lookout for that word bankruptcy.
Sure.
I mean, that would obviously be a red flag. Emily, do you want to weigh in on this as well? And no. Okay, that's fair enough. Let me get Francis from Cape May to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Francis. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I was told that if you put DuPont's pollution liability against their assets, they really wouldn't be worth much.
That's a real good question. I think the problem with that equation is we don't really know what the liability is.
I think maybe they do.
You know, I'm sure they do have estimates. I know that if you go to the lawyers for the plaintiffs, like the big case in the Ohio Valley against Chemours and DuPont, you know, they would say that the limits are very, very high. The company, can they be successful in getting that down? Can they get a couple of favorable court decisions? Can they drag this thing out for so long that it's not so expensive? You know, you may know more about it than I do. I'm sure DuPont has best case scenarios and worst case scenarios, and they're going to try and bank this based on some of the better scenarios for them.
Yeah, Francis, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you can call as well, just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Again, talking with our guests, Joe DiStefano and Emily Feldman, about the proposed merger between DuPont and Dow Chemical. And it was announced on Friday. Big news here in the Delaware Valley, and certainly big news in the business world as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Emily, I mean, looking ahead and I guess into whatever crystal ball still exists, it's hard sometimes to predict these things. Yeah. But are things like pensions and some of the liability issues that our caller just raised and health care, are these the kinds of responsibilities that these future companies want to get out from under?
So it's something that needs to be managed carefully by the divesting company. So in this case, it would be kind of the combined Dow-DuPont entity that's been created by this merger. So they have a responsibility to allocate these liabilities fairly across the businesses that they're splitting up. They can't, for example, dump all of the environmental liabilities into one business and then spin that off as an independent company. That's not going to fly.
And then declare bankruptcy.
Right. That doesn't work. That's not legal, right? So there are limits on sort of what can be done. But I'm sure more details will be forthcoming from the company going forward. Yeah.
What happens next, Joe? I mean, let's talk about going forward. So we had this big announcement on Friday, and then all this reaction, obviously. So what's the next move in the timetable?
Sure. So the people who want the merger, the CEOs of the two companies, those are the investors who buy the story. You know, they want to move this thing forward with all, you know, due speed. And, you know, they're going to do their layoffs and they're going to do their cuts. Both companies are committed to lots and lots of cost cuts before the merger and before the merger comes along. And then in the meantime, you've got all the very long list of potential opponents to this deal, you know, who are going
like who?
To.
Who's an opponent?
Well, you know, Senator Grassley has said his farmers could be opponents unless they get what they want. You've got unions representing some of the plants, by no means all of them. Now, I've talked to some union reps who are very happy with divestment because they've been able to get into some plants that they were not able to get into when they were big corporations. When you're working for a much smaller company, there are guys and women in the process units who say, you know, we need some protection here. We need to talk to some people who've seen this before. And so these guys are out there organizing some very small plants, which is an interesting development a lot of people wouldn't have expected. Then you've got the competitors. You know, competitors are looking and saying, well, do I think that these guys are going to get so powerful that, you know, I have a good case in opposing this and saying that at least they ought to sell me part of the business so that, you know, I don't get driven out illegally. Then you have the people who maybe don't have that good a case, but they think that by obstructing and getting in the way and giving money to the opponents and talking to their congresspeople, they can make life harder for DuPont and Dow. That's a big fear inside the company. Is there are people who say, look, we've been through mergers and they're incredibly disruptive. They confuse the client, the customers, they confuse the employee. That makes it hard to hire good young people. It makes it hard to keep managers. And the longer this thing takes, you know, the less likely it is that they'll reach the goals that they have. Again, you look back at the Comcast-Time Warner merger, and there was everything from community activists to small channels to Bloomberg News to competitors who didn't want to see this thing happen. In the end, it did not happen.
Yeah, interesting. And should we keep our eyes on Daniel Loeb and Nelson Peltz, Emily?
Well, definitely, yeah. So I actually just want to piggyback off of one thing that Joe just said, and then I'll answer your question about the activists. So, you know, one thing that I think is really interesting about this, so let's assume that we make it through all of the troubles and travails that Joe just outlined for us, right? So what's cool about this merger is that it's you know, it's a big merger. It's called a merger of equals. It's being built that way. But it's not likely to face many of the same sorts of challenges that one normally experiences in kind of these large company deals in terms of post-merger integration, right? So we're unlikely to see sort of a need to, you know, very deeply integrate and tie together all the different pieces of the Dow and DuPont organizations, precisely because they're going to break apart kind of in the long term. So the integration happens on a much lower scale, right? It happens within the divisions that need to be combined as opposed to the corporation as a whole. So I think that's a noteworthy point to bear in mind here that, again, kind of adds some brightness maybe to this deal. To continue with your question about sort of the activists and, yes. and Dan Loeb and Nelson Peltz, right? So they've obviously had really, really big influence, as has the activist community more generally, on American corporations, right? You can sort of tick off a whole list of companies that have been sort of touched by these types of investors, right? And I think what we're seeing right now is a big wave of sort of rationalization, divestitures, spinoffs that are being advocated for by these individuals precisely because they do create value. And what's interesting is that this actually the behavior that we're seeing by these investors is actually mirrored in kind of academic research. So I have a research study that I'm working on right now in which I quantify the financial implications, so the shareholder returns to divestitures that are impelled or pushed by these activist investors versus those that are not. And what I find in this study is that the activist-impelled divestitures and spinoffs actually outperform by an order of magnitude the divestitures that are not activist-impelled. So again, we're looking at this whole subsample of sort of slimming down, breaking down companies. So that's a contingency that is important to bear in mind. But the activist-impelled ones are doing a lot better than the non-activist-impelled ones. And I think that that's important.
For shareholders.
For yes. shareholders, yeah. Gotcha. I think that what's important for the purposes of this conversation is that, you know, we're looking at this Dow-DuPont breakup and, you know, we're seeing exactly this strategy played out in practice. You know, so I think that, and, you know, we're seeing it elsewhere as well, right? So I think that's an important point to underscore here, sort of the long-term implications there.
And what it I must hear, work because they keep doing it.
What's that?
It must work because they keep doing it. Yeah. She's got the science.
It works in that shareholders are rewarded for the breakup.
Apparently, so, yeah. I mean, they make money. Just the talk about them coming
in. Yeah, I mean, the shareholders are rewarded, but you have to remember that the stock price is reflective of what's going on within the company. You know, as I said at the beginning of the call, you know, we do see sort of these operating improvements, you know, better allocation of capital, better allocation of resources, more efficient use of corporate resources, less bureaucracy in terms of coordinating across divisions. You know, all of this translates into the returns that shareholders earn, even if there are some bumps along the way, it translates into the returns that shareholders earn from these companies. So that's a piece of this too.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here, someone had a question. What happens to Children's Hospital in Wilmington as a result of the merger? Joe, have you thought about that, looked into that?
AI DuPont. Now, you know, the DuPont family has factions. And the faction that lost the fight over the DuPont company way back in the teens and 20s is the one that ended up endowing the AI DuPont Hospital. And my understanding is they long ago diversified their assets. They are a wealthy, wealthy group, and they have just built a second hospital down in Florida. They had enough money to do that. They have hugely expanded AI in Wilmington. They got single rooms. They got a beautiful structure where they airlifted the new rooms into it. I don't think they're going to be too much affected. The Longwood Foundation and the rest of those, not so much. It's the direct DuPont corporate giving. And the institutions, the golf clubs, the theaters, the things in Wilmington that they sponsor that have more to be worried about.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Joe DiStefano, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Business reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Emily Feldman, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And she's assistant professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Also talked with Dennis Berman, financial editor of the Wall Street Journal. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. And we officially welcome Liz Fiedler to Radio Times. She was a reporter in the WHYY newsroom. She's now a Radio Times producer. We couldn't be happier. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.